Okay, hello everybody. My name is Gijs. I don't expect you to remember that, but I thought maybe you could try it as an exercise. It's a bit similar to the sound you hear after an overnight train journey when everybody wakes up in the morning and goes. So remember that, and then hopefully you'll remember my name. So my name is Gijs. I've been working in Oroville, as Jeff and Thomas already mentioned, on this planning process. Before that, I was working with cotton in Vidarbha and in Andhra Pradesh. And which do I think do I?
Middle,
the middle one. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about food systems and then share some of the experiences that we had with this planning process in Oroville. And then I was told that the audience consists mainly of planners and project developers, both urban and rural. So I'll try, I hope you identify with that label. Then I'll try to explain the relevance of what we are trying to do to those areas of work. In terms of food systems, I just wanted to explain from a theoretical point of view where we're coming from. Certain elements of, at least my thinking, are that we are working in a larger system. So we're just one of many, many species. And even as a society, the economy is just a subset of total social systems. And I did have a picture to go with that. So if you look at nested systems, it's a bit like a Russian doll, you know? You put the it fits. So basically, whatever you do in your economy, you're not going to change society. And whatever you're going to do in your human system, you're not going to change the fact that we are made of water and bacteria and micro nutrients and so forth. So there are real boundaries that we have to take into consideration when we're doing our planning. Oops, sorry. Second point is that if you look at, like Priya was mentioning, you look at the natural systems around us in the biosphere, you see that often they're not linear, they're cyclical. So when we talk about food, very often we're talking about supply chain management and getting a product from A to B, and then we think it's a straight line. Whereas in actual fact, it's more like this, it's more like a circle. There is no A to B. The B to A is the same circle. And to illustrate this with an example, this was an example of a food value, sorry, it's not a food value chain, it's a textile value chain that I was working with in Vidarbha. So we had the farmers and then all the different processing. Thomas was also mentioning the importance of processing. Again, back to the consumers. Now, in this case, in textile, it was very clear that they were completely disconnected because you had your farmers in Vidarbha and your consumers could be in New York or in Paris or in Milan. So they had no idea about each other. What you're trying to do is actually connect the dots and bring them together in a room. And this is an approach which we'll also go to in a bit more detail, what we tried in Oroville. So the cyclical element as well as the nested system element. Then finally, the challenges. If we talk about sustainability, there are so many different elements and so many different challenges related to each element. They'd really push us to go for a bottom-up network approach. So in terms of planning, I think it's really critical that the age of blueprints are over. Although they're very easily manageable and they're on the table, they look very nice. In actual fact, reality demands a drastically different approach. And this is where I see big opportunity for value chains, because you could see value chains as a conglomeration of different elements. You could see this as, this is from a book called The Gort Cloud. It's basically about managing green ventures in the information age. And you can see different sub-clouds of stakeholders. And all of these clouds, in all of these clouds, perception is being generated simultaneously. So your point of view is just a point of view. And to navigate through this, you really have to be quite open and and listen to what's going on and design your value chains or your systems or your institutions in such a way that they're actually open to be surprised and to incorporate this complexity. So then on to the more practical work, what we're actually doing in Oroville. As I mentioned before, we try to bring the whole system in the room, so that all different links in the value chain. And this is a practical example of how we did that. There you see some familiar faces. So we here, what we try to do is analyze who are the stakeholders in the Oroville food system. As Thomas already mentioned, we have Oroville farmers. We also have farmers in the bioregion. As you can see here, this is a group of farmers in the bioregion sampling some Oroville retail. And then we brought everybody in the room and tried to create a common perception on which we could base a common strategy. And this, to follow up this strategy, you actually need to change your governance. So rather than right now in Oroville, we have a farm group and all the farmers are there. We don't even have a food group, but hopefully a food group will be founded soon. Then all the food sector, food units are there, your distribution, your retail, etc. And you have a planning group policy, it's again separate. Whereas this complex, this network system demands a more multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary approach. And actually this has political consequences because it means that governance, then that institution would have to have some power and some funding to make system level decisions. We did about 6 months research about the Oroville consumption patterns, the footprints, and we explored different CPPs. I'm sure you all heard of PPPs, public-private partnerships. Now we're talking about consumer-producer partnerships. And I really think this is the way to go, and both for your urban planning as well as for your rural planning. Remember this term, the CPP. It actually has a bit of a political, I don't know, it looks like a communist party of Pondicherry, but it's not. It's a consumer-producer partnership. And in terms of the how to structure this consumer-producer partnership, one of the ideas that we're exploring is, as Thomas mentioned, you can give cash as a premium if you want farmer groups in the bioregion to grow organic food. My experience has been that if you introduce cash too early on in the process, it tends to, I don't know, it has this magnetic characteristic where people then only are interested in that cash. And there is also an alternative which could be thought of, which actually almost was tried in Oroville. It's called a local exchange trade system, but it was tried in the entire community, which is a bit too complex, apparently. You could also try it in a subsystem. In this case, in the food system, you could have a food system LETS, a local exchange trade system, or LETS. And everybody knows food miles, but here we're introducing a concept called food smiles. How would this work? In Oroville, we'd have a collective procurement agency. We call it FoodLink. It links producers to consumers. They actually source the raw material from farmers and then they pay a premium in the form of smiles. And the farmers, they say, all right, these are all my needs. If you want food, okay, but I need inputs, I need these services and so forth. And then they could actually offer these smiles to the service providers and input suppliers who could again use it to cover their needs, because if you're an input supplier or a service provider, your needs are most likely to be in the area of business development and organization development. And this happens to be an area of expertise where we get a lot of free labor in Oroville. But the free labor is not interested to actually support input suppliers, they are interested to support the farmers. So in this case, the food smiles could potentially be a way to link this pro bono professional services and make them, you basically cash in on that support. A bit more technical, Priya mentioned that there is a big demand for eggs, and we can see that she was right. There's actually a demand of 57 tons of eggs, and we're not producing that many. We're only producing less than 10 tons of eggs. So there's 5 or 6 times more demand for eggs. This shows you, the red is the production inside Oroville, and the blue shows you the consumption. So you see the supply-demand gap, and you see that it's focusing on different products. And obviously, rice is a big staple. I didn't include all the exotics like your cabbages and your carrots and your wheat because there's no point even trying to grow them here. The climate has this way of saying no. But tomatoes, bananas, eggs, rice, actually milk even dropped off the chart. It was about 120 tons. You know, there's serious potential there. Now, what that means in terms of your land use pattern, we could run different scenarios. My background, by the way, I'm an agriculture engineer. They train us to do these kind of modelings and simulations and scenario plannings. It never works in practice, but it's nice, you know, generates nice graphs. So if you have two scenarios, you could look at a maximum yield level scenario where, you know, by all means possible, you grow vegetables. Actually, we took only about 4.5 tons an acre, whereas it's possible to grow 10 tons an acre vegetables. So it's not even the maximum, but it's a lot more maximum than's happening now, about 3 times as more as maximum. You could also look at a more realistic yield, maybe 2.5 tons an acre, 3 tons an acre. At maximum yield levels, you can grow all domestically producible or bioregionally producible food on about 200 acres. Currently, there's about 100 acres under real production in Oroville. You could grow everything that you need, with a big caveat. This is excluding fodder for your milk or for your chickens. This is just the food that people eat directly. You could grow that on 200 acres with maximum yield. If you go to a more realistic yield, you need 400 acres. And currently, Oroville has about 300 acres in total available for farming. So at realistic yield levels, another 100 acres would be needed. This is again for the current resident base of 2,000 people. So you can multiply that tenfold for 20,000, which is, I think, one of the aims of the planning group. Also, you can see that in terms of the land use and the consumption, there's a bit of a disconnect where we seem to be favoring cashew production. People don't seem to eat that much cashew. Yeah, rice obviously is a major issue. And for rice, it really seems that the only way out is CPPs. And I'll get to more options in terms of your CPPs. And this also brings us to what you could think of if you imagine yourself as an urban project developer. So you're doing a gated community, say for 2,000 residents. Your CPP options could be consumer-supported agriculture. We're actually trying that in Oroville right now, where the consumers get whatever the farm produces. They don't have a choice. Sometimes they even pre-finance the farmer. So they're very intimately involved with the production process of their food. They get a newsletter, say, every week about the status of the farm. It's great fun, and it's also a challenge to make up recipes with that surprise that you have in your basket every week. It's very popular in Europe. Another option is fair trade and organic certification. This is possible at larger scales as well. The fair trade certification for domestic markets in India is just picking up. There's a group called Shop for Change. Shop for Change is developing a domestic fair trade label. They started with textiles, but now they're also going to launch other products, including food. Organic market, just like Thomas was saying, it'll probably come because people are actually quite scared about the adulteration. And if you would do a test on pesticide residues on the vegetables in your mandi, you would be very scared. So this is definitely going to grow. Then another model is town-village twinning. So maybe the urban planners and the rural planners in the room could get together, and then you could twin your number of villages to start producing food for a certain town, and you could build up a long-term relationship My experience is that actually a lot of consumers are very excited about the meaning that they derive from this connection to rural life. And agritourism, for example, is also a booming business, which you could include in such town-village twinning approach. Then on a more conventional level, the government of India is pushing quite enthusiastically contract farming. However, there's a lot of riders with contract farming, in Latin America. You could look for examples what happens if you give contract farming the free rein. And basically what it means is that the supermarkets, and same in Europe, supermarkets control the entire value chain. It's definitely a linear A to B process in which the supermarkets, they call the shots, they whistle, everybody else jumps. And all risk is basically pushed towards the farmer. So if there's a weather risk, it's the problem of the farmer. If there's a bounty, then suddenly the supermarkets change their quality norms and they manage to always squeeze the primary producer. This is exactly the same way that contract farming is going in India right now. But the government is excited because it includes some technical support. So rather than the extension system being overburdened, now the Reliance Fresh or Birla group could relieve some of that government responsibility. Definitely doesn't have, obviously, as you can see, my preference. In terms of urban planning, you know, why is it relevant? If I'd be a customer of a gated community, I'd be really excited about sustainable food offered as a service to me as a resident. If my local kirana shop actually gives me something more than the anonymous pesticide residue goods, you know, I'd see that as a plus. So it could be a USP for your urban project, just like you're offering security with watchmen and guards and the gates itself, and water services and energy and education nearby and so forth. It's quite critical, no, to a human species to have healthy food. The second element why I think it's relevant for urban planning is that there's a lot of talk about green building and LEED certification and so forth, but the buildings you construct only once. The food, actually, it's an ongoing impact. Every day your 2,000 people consume food and they have a big footprint. So if you want to actually have a sustainable urban community, I really need to try hard to get into the urban language because I'm an agriculture engineer. So in terms of the footprint of your urban development, I think it makes a lot of sense to incorporate food. Finally, what we actually are starting to experiment with in Oroville is this talk about diet. So Priya already mentioned that maybe we shouldn't be eating too many eggs. Maybe we shouldn't actually be eating brinjals in the off season. Maybe, you know, we should replace our potatoes with yam and our rice with vargu. If you have collective kitchens, you can actually start doing that. You can start introducing new food to consumers because they don't have a choice. You know, they want to not cook. Okay, no, don't cook, but then eat the vargu. And also, I guess Mark will go into that in a bit more detail. Community kitchens are a central meeting place, a community building hub. I'm sure it will have all kinds of spin-offs in terms of, you know, more active residents, improved security, and so forth. And the information, you know, when I was working with cotton, it's the fight for like 5 seconds of a consumer's time. They're shopping with loud music in a retail shop, and then, you know, you want to, they scan through the racks, and you want to catch them for like even 5 seconds or even half a second. This is an entirely different story. They sit there for an hour, you know, on that table. They don't move. So, you know, that mind space is open for you to colonize with your ideas about sustainable lifestyles. So I'd really advise urban planners to make use of that opportunity. Okay, interesting. My rural and urban are mixed. So that was for the cities. This is actually for the villages. I didn't see that bug, sorry. So rural development is actually my background. And generally what happens is that you end up writing grants. You know, you write a grant for 3 years, it's off. You go to a different donor. You write a grant for 3 years, it's off. You go to a different donor or get a different government department, or you call it, instead of a gender project, you call it an HIV project, or you call it a water project, but you're actually doing the same work. In the case of your CPPs, you don't actually need to keep writing these grants, because what you can do is you can make use of the economic system, and a part of the value created, you can plow back into your institutions or into your admin. And this is, we have some very positive experiences with this in Fairtrade Cotton, where in about 6 years' time, they could shift from donor dependency to self-sufficiency, financial self-sufficiency, just by charging, it was 6 rupees per kilo, so that's about 2 rupees on a t-shirt, which obviously the consumer doesn't even notice. Another opportunity for rural projects is ecosystem services. So when you're thinking of the added benefits that you're creating for a society, it's not just that you're growing more healthy food, and even that you could calculate, you could say that I'm actually reducing the health and hospitalization costs, or I'm reducing your cost of diabetes, but you're also producing clean water. So you could actually be paid for this, and this is already happening in, for example, with New York, where in the Catskills in North State New York, they're paying farmers not to spray, because actually cleaning the pesticide residues out of the drinking water is more expensive than giving the farmers a premium. Another ecosystem service that is nowadays very popular, of course, are your carbon credits. That could generate, if you switch from conventional to organic farming, it could generate about 400 rupees an acre. If you have a large amount of acres, that's actually a substantial amount of money. And I think something that we're going to see soon are biodiversity credits. And Priya, with her pests, might qualify for biodiversity credits. Finally, I think a big opportunity, and this is not from the Oroville experience, I'm sorry, this is from the Cotton experience, but I think a big opportunity for those of you who are into rural development projects are community enterprises. When you have a group of farmers and they're into aggregation, into collective quality control, logistics, marketing, distribution, and so forth, even extension, of course, the extension they're going to give is much more relevant than the extension that Reliance Fresh or Birla is going to give, because they're actually the consumers of the knowledge. It also will allow them to have a better negotiation position and more independence. But what's, I think, most critical is that they can actually invest as a community-based organization. They can invest in village development and also negotiate better with governments supplying basic services. So generally, there are lots of schemes for rural development projects, but they're totally underutilized. If you have a group of organized, mobilized, organic, fair trade, CPP, town, village, twinned farmers, they could actually hold the government accountable. So these were some of the findings from both Oroville as well as my earlier work in cotton value chains, and I'd be interested to catch up with you over lunch. Thank you very much.